Myself and my collaborator, agronomist Shannon Osborne, are located in Brookings, South Dakota. We both work for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Agricultural Research Service. Great talk by Matt. We do have some data on different fungal communities as they're associated with cover crop variety, and Dr. Soledad Benitez will present that data tomorrow in session 271, I believe, at around starting at around 11 o'clock. So as a lead-in from Matt's concluding statement. So if you drive around the upper Midwest or nearly anywhere where the land is dominated by row cropping, over half the year, this is what the surface of the land looks like. That's not good. But there's an alternative, and the alternative is cover cropping. If you have cover crops when the cash crop is not planted, you're capturing free energy all the time. You're injecting carbon and nitrogen in the ground, you're improving the water dynamics of the soil, and you're reducing erosion. It's a great, I mean, it's win-win-win all the way around. Whoa, wait a second, what about yield? Well, this is data from 2014 across the U.S. aggregated the effect of cover crops on corn yields, and actually the cover crop fields yielded higher number of bushels of corn than the non-cover crop fields. And so this site that's cited at the bottom of the slide has data from, I think, 2012, 13, and 14, also by state. So if you're thinking, well, that can't be done in our state, go take a look at the data. It has been done. So if you're in this session, you've probably heard about soil health and the NRCS's huge emphasis in the past year and a half building an entire program. But it's not just the NRCS who have always been about soil. You know, they were the SCS before they were NRCS. But what's interesting is this time around, soil health is attracting the interest of private foundations like the Buffett Foundation, the Walt Foundation, folks with pretty deep pockets and a lot of influence. And it's also attracting the interest of agribusiness and other types of stakeholders. And in summary, the momentum right now is huge. And so that's part of why I'm up here talking about our research. When people such as the communities and the stakeholders that were that are involved in the efforts in that previous slide talk about soil health, a lot of it is really about soil biology, which is integral to soil health. And as a scientist, you know, I start with the easy questions. Can we measure changes in soil biology? Are they meaningful in response to cover crops? What are the critical time scales? When do you go out and measure it? And how long do you think it will take to see an effect of the cover cropping? And then we have a lot of contact with producers and other stakeholders. The question is, they want to know is, what's the benefits for me? And these are all, as you may appreciate, very difficult questions to answer. And it's not like we're starting from scratch. Of course, there's been work done for decades, and there was a big push in the 90s. And we're just this is just the latest wave to push this concept along, trying to define it further, provide the tools so that producers will actually use tactics like cover cropping to improve their soil, and they can report that it resulted in improvements in soil health, and there is a strong interest in that. Don't underestimate it. So at our research facility, we have one set of research plots that were established in 2000, originally to assess the effects of residue management, and then in 2005, a second factor was added, cover crops. These are all no-till. It's a corn-soybean rotation. The primary treatment is residue removal with three levels of corn stover removal. And then cover crops, a variety of cover crops have been used. They were planted into both the corn and soybean, and either broadcast in late season, or if the crop happened to be harvested early, then they were direct drilled in. In either case, establishment is fairly variable depending upon the weather conditions for that fall. So typical surfaces, I said three levels of residue removal, grain only. We just remove the grain, LRR, low residue removal. Grain and stover, we bale the stover and remove it. Silage, we cut it as low as we can and take everything off. So that's 15 years of management like this from the corn phase, the corn and soybean. And what we measured was fungal bacterial ratios. And the reason why we measured fungal bacterial ratios is they've been shown to be correlated with carbon and nitrogen retention in a variety of terrestrial systems. And we used a qPCR technique. There's obviously there's PLFA, there's physiological methods, there's direct observation methods, all have plus and minuses. We used quantitative PCR, 16S and ITS regions for the fungi. And what we found, here's our data, fungal bacterial ratios on the y-axis, and then the dark bars have no cover crop, and with increasing residue removal moving left to right across the slide, we see decreased fungal bacterial ratios. And then the second factor, the split plot, with the cover crops, we're able to retain the high level of fungal bacterial. And the way I interpret this is that we were able to retain roughly the same composition of the soil microbial community, and we were probably able to retain more carbon and nitrogen in the system. Okay? So we repeated this analysis with the collaborator Jeff Beyer and Jude Maul, who was the first speaker this morning, on a tomato cropping system in Beltsville. And other analyses were done, of course, on this study. And again, we found that a vetch cover crop significantly elevated the cover or the fungal bacterial ratios compared to a black poly cover. And this data is good. And there's a lot of people out there pushing fungal bacterial ratios, but I still don't think we've really laid the groundwork to demonstrate that these are really, really defensible measures of soil quality that we can attach to some benefit for the producer. But I think they're a work in progress. But it turns out farmers aren't trying to grow and sell fungi and bacteria. So it only goes so far in terms of convincing them that this is a good thing. But if you talk about nitrogen, you get specifically nitrogen that you measure, you start to get their attention a little bit more. So we had a little different system here, and I guess I can't seem to work the pointer here. Oh, there we go. Little different system here from the previous one. This is soybean spring wheat, harvested August, cover crop planted, terminated the next spring, and corn planted, and we used an in situ nitrogen mineralization technique to look at the nitrogen mineralized during the corn, about 10 weeks in the corn growing season following the termination of the cover, fallow, rye, hairy vetch, sweet clover. And here's the data. We looked at 3 years of this. This is just 1 year that I'm giving you as an example. Again, soybeans, small grains, cover crop, we start looking at the in situ nitrogen mineralization was the highest following clover, the least after fallow, intermediate with rye and vetch. So this is good, but as I thought more about it, you know, the rye has a pretty high seed end ratio, but it might be releasing nitrogen and improving the soil and providing plant nutrients for a lot longer than, say, the fairly labile, low seed end ratio clover. So have we given these cover crops a fair shake by simply looking at the nitrogen that's mineralized for the next 10 weeks after we terminate them? And I'm not certain of that. More recently, we've been starting to measure potentially mineralizable N, and I believe that that may be a better measure of this effect. We have done a lot of work looking at arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi as indicators, these obligate plant symbionts. Obviously, if you have no cover crop there, if it's fallow, you've got no plant host, so they can't reproduce, they can't complete their life cycle. In agricultural systems, the number of arbuscular mycorrhizae fungi is generally very low compared to a native prairie. There's a lot of different reasons why this has been found. Cover cropping actually helps with most of these. It eliminates seasonal fallow. It diversifies the rotation. It provides additional fertilizer so we can reduce the inputs. It alleviates compaction, and in a lot of cases, cover cropping is performed with no-till. So you're really getting a lot of things here that may affect these obligate symbionts that are often beneficial to their plant host in terms of nutrient acquisition, water uptake, pest and pathogen protection. So we think this is a pretty good indicator. The problem is they're kind of hard to measure. And there's a lot of techniques out there. Some of them are old, some of them are new, but the bottom line is they're kind of hard to measure. So we set up with two different studies. One's at our research farm, one was at a producer's field. These are both replicated. No cover crops, canola, oats, vetch, various combinations. Here we had some other combinations. The canola is not a mycorrhizal host. And I will go to the data. We measured mycorrhizal propagules by the most probable number. This is a hugely labor-intensive process. If you're doing a lot of soils, this is hard won data. Here's our treatments at our site. 3 years of data. Again, we're measuring fall. We're sampling in the fall right before it goes into winter. The cover crop, fall growth of the cover crop is at its peak. And we found that oats in every situation produce significantly higher propagule numbers. Again, the mixture of oats, vetch, and canola was also effective. And I think part of that is because we're measuring in the fall and the oats took off and grew in the fall a lot more vigorously than the vetch and the canola. We, at the producer's field, we only had 1 year of data, but again, we see a significant increase in the mycorrhizal propagules with an oats pea mixture. And again, we're sampling at the same point in the same kind of rotation. At a third place, we went to a producer's field who has a very complex rotation, and in that rotation is wheat, cover crops, corn. We sampled here in paired locations where you had cover crops and didn't, and again we see a significant increase. Very high numbers. This farmer had been no-till, diversified rotation, cover crops, low phosphorus application for decades, and we think it shows, but it's N equals one, really. It's one farmer, and to do all this work at multiple farms is quite an undertaking. So we started doing some interseeding at our location where we interseed both corn and soybean with the cover crops. And this gets away from, hey, I'm going to have a cover crop after just small grains. This starts to put it in there every year and not make it as susceptible to establishment with the fall rains and a northern climate. And so this is the establishment under a corn canopy and a soybean canopy in the fall before harvest. And this is in the spring before planting. Getting close here. So I'm going to skip this slide and just tell you, we use the CO2 burst test where the soil is moistened and you look at the CO2 burst following it. And we used a gas chromatograph instead of this colorimetric indicator, and this method has been correlated with biomass and mineralizable N, and we applied it after the first year of this study in no-till and till, and the cover had a higher CO2 burst, presumably higher biomass, higher potentially mineralizable nitrogen in the soybean, but not in the corn, although in the corn we did see an effect of till, and so it appears there's an interaction between crop and tillage with regard to this measurement. This measurement is relatively rapid, so we can take a lot of samples throughout the year and capture some of the variability. So in the end, I'd say the research community faces some the same challenges I presented at the very beginning. And the difference in my career at this time is the interest from stakeholders and the momentum and the level of urgency that I'm seeing, and the fact that if we don't do it as scientists, they're going to do it. And they'll have some scientist help, but they won't have as much scientist engagement and involvement. And I think it's a really great time to rise to this. It's nice to have people, stakeholders, demanding your data. And with that, I'd like to acknowledge my funding and take questions if time permits. Thank you.